I'm going to write. I don't know whether you can see this. Can you see that? Is it visible on the back row? If not, come to the front. Does anybody know what that is? It's the name of God. And we're talking about the meaning of this magical name. It's called the Tetragrammaton, the original four-letter word, fundamentally ruder than any other word that's ever been penned, because rude means pertaining to the root. This name is referring to the root power of ultimate reality. We're going to write it in another way, namely vertically. This is the way it's normally written, and you wouldn't normally, if you were Jewish, pronounce that word like Christians do. Christians would translate it into Jehovah. Orthodox Jews would not. They would say Adonai, Lord, instead. The reason they do that is because they say it is an unpronounceable name, by which they mean that when we pronounce this letter and this and this and this in time, we're pronouncing separately letters that should be pronounced simultaneously. So supposing we have four volunteers. One is going to say for that yod, that's a letter yod, a jot. He's going to say ya. One is going to say for this letter hey. One is going to say for this letter va. And one is going to say for this, like that one, hey. One is going to say ya, one will say hey, one will say va, one will say hey. Can I have four volunteers who will do that? Well, at least four will do. Will you take your letters? That's what they do in the army, isn't it? Volunteer, you. When you say that letter, yeah, and you say, hey, you say, the, and you say, hey, and I'll count down. You must say them together. Yes? 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
Now, did you hear all those letters simultaneously? You didn't? Is it because you were deaf or because they weren't shouting loud enough? Not loud enough. Try and get simultaneously now, after the countdown. Are we ready? Take deep breaths. 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
Did you get it? Did I hear someone say no? It sounds like Zeta. Didn't you say, Mom was late? Well, was it a vague idea of a possibility? Yes? Better? You seem to be the chief critic. Would you like to do one of them? I'll let you off the hook, so on. Now, you don't mind being off the hook? Oh, I see, yes. That one is called the hook. Now, we will look at this in another way. If we cut it in the middle, reading this way is called Hebraica, and reading that way is anti-Hebraica. If we read it this way, it spells who, he. I'll write H-U. H-I, who he. Now that's Hebrew for he, that's this one, and she. Typically Jewish thought that he really means she. Right? Who he is the name of God. Or he who. We say he who created the universe. That means she, he created the universe. You all know this stuff, it's called Kabbalistic thinking. Now I'm going to write it slightly differently. That's a dot big enough for someone to see. Can you see that? This bar is the hay. And this bar is a valve. And this bar is another hay. I've now written the same name, but vertically. Does it make to you a fairly simple, primitive drawing of a man? Because that's what it means, a man. That yod or yod, which in Hebrew signifies a hand or instrument, is your head. Because through your intelligence you become an instrument of the infinite God. This letter hey, shoulder bar, arm, is your breathing power. That's your head, that's your chest. And this bar is your pelvic bar, your two legs. Now, you know that God, when he showed himself to Moses, so that he didn't frighten him too much, he put him in a cleft in a rock, and then he put his hand over it so that he couldn't see, and then to make sure he didn't see, he ran past him backwards. Now imagine poor Moses put in a cleft in the rock, and then God, to make sure he's not too shocking, puts his hand over the cleft, and then he rushes by with his back to Moses. So this is a back view. That's very, very important. It's a back view because you notice this arm is quite good, attached to the shoulder. This one is disjoined, broken. And this leg is attached, and this one is disjoined. It is broken. That's a reference to Jacob fighting an angel of God and suffering a dislocated joint in the process. We'll see what that means in a minute. The essential thing about this is that in this drawing of God, this letter Vav, which, as Greta knows, having done the homework, euphemistically is referred to as a nail or hook. This letter originally in the Egyptian is written like that. That's a trifle obvious, isn't it? It means male drive. But you're not to equate it with the physical organ that's pendant from the pubic area in the male. That's called a penis. A physical organ, and that is not called the phallus. The phallus itself means the power that invests itself in the generative act. So it's not the physical organ, but the power. Now in this diagram, which represents God, this organ, which is phallic, which is primordial drive, is rooted in the heart. I think it's rooted in the heart. So that creativity actually springs from the center of feeling, the center of kindness, of compassion, of appreciation of the needs of beings in relation. It comes from the heart. And with God, if we put an Egyptian cartouche around that like that, because you make Egyptian names obvious by putting a cartouche around them, it says God's intelligence and his executive powers, his arms, and his moving powers, his legs, receive their drive from the heart, from feeling. Now let's see if we draw another man. We won't waste much time on this one because this is just an ordinary man. This is called a fallen man. This center of feeling has now fallen and is hanging down there. Looking at those two drawings, which one do you prefer from feeling?
The first one.
Can you feel this feels a bit empty here? It's got an admirable appendage, but there's nothing there. Now the whole key of successful relationship between human beings of opposite sexes rests in this diagram. As long as you are centered in the heart, so that you have compassion, feeling for the kind of person you are dealing with, then you are not fallen. But if that generative power that's truly rooted in the heart falls in consciousness downwards to that excretory organ pendant on the pelvic area, if it falls down there, it has no feeling whatever for the relation at the emotional level with the other being. In which case, the man centered in the fallen organ has no consideration whatever for a female partner. No kindness. He doesn't treat her in her kind. He merely wishes to exercise this pendant organ without feeling, without emotional relation. Now that is the fallen man, and the fall from the heart down to that pubic area occurred at a certain stage of the history of the human race. And you may know that some fellows are very sensitive and they can't go into a sexual relation with a woman unless they actually like her. They must actually feel something for her. Some kindness, some compassion, some relation of emotion. And if they haven't got that, they can't relate. But there are many men who can relate to a woman for whom they have no consideration whatever, and they use her as a frictive device to exercise that fallen organ. Let's consider that very, very carefully, the difference between keeping one's feeling of generative power in the heart, in the center of affection, and allowing the consciousness to drop down to the pubic area, where there is no compassion whatever. And what kind of a relation is it? Where a male fallen into that area is thinking about the female who could be a partner, not as a partner, but as an instrument for sensuous, frictive self-gratification and nothing else. Now, can it be true? Can it be good? Can it be beautiful? If that organ consciousness has fallen, so there's no natural affection, there is no awareness, nor any desire for there to be any awareness of the kind of person to whom one is relating. You see this in the most extreme forms, in the stray associations of a man with a prostitute that he's never met before and he may never meet again, and he pays his money and he gets his friction and he goes away and he doesn't want to know her. He just wants to get rid of what he calls his tensions. He's fallen. Now, as long as he's fallen in that way, then certain things cannot happen in his evolution. He cannot evolve as a full human being unless he's lifted up. When it says, lift up your hearts, the reference is to this. The heart has fallen down, so the feeling has descended into this low level. Now, when we are considering this name, if we were to draw the yod there and the hay there and the vav there and then surround them with a triangle, we made ourselves a nice little pendant. The reason the triangle is put there is to remind you of a threefold unavoidable fact, absolutely unavoidable, permanent throughout all universes. This doubt means form, this hay means feeling, and this valve means drive. In psychological terms, it is called cognition or ideation, affection, conation. Forming thinking in the mind, feeling, liking, disliking, and compulsive driving. Now, they make an inseparable trine, a threefold dynamic fact. But there is a reference to a hay, that's that letter, in exile. Outside the triangle is another hay. Think what that means. This letter hay means life. Kabbalistically it is said, God said, I have made the universe with a hay. That means to say, with life feeling. I have made it with life feeling, a feeling for life. I have made the universe of beings with a feeling for life. And then islanded off individuals like that, so that each one is a triplicity of thought, feeling, and will, inside the island of the body. The skin surface is the limit of that island. If we write isle in here, isle, ile, you could write an s if you wish, it's the same word, then for this hay we'd have to write x. Isle. This one is called hay in exile, outside the island. Now you know when you breathe, which you have to do in order to live, air comes from outside the binding skin of your being and goes into your nostrils, or if you're an unfortunate mouth breather, mainly through the mouth, but the nose is designed especially to warm it and filter it and so on. It goes in, and you take from it the oxygen you need, and then you breathe out from the body things you don't need. If we did not breathe, we would die. That's an absolute essential. You can die quicker of short of breath than you can of short of food or drink. So imagine an infinite atmosphere. The atmosphere is the same word as the Sanskrit Atman. Intelligent self-field of power, infinitely extended, and it has posited inside itself little islands, which are life. That big hay there is in here in the island. That's your chest and your lungs, breathing in the spirit into the being. And then from that oxygen and the dynamism involved in it, one can think and one can drive into action within the island of our being. An anthropologist would call that the isle of the tonal. The civilized part of being is inside there. But there's an infinity of life power beyond any individual. Outside your skin, there is atmosphere waiting to be breathed. It extends outwards. Around the earth we have an atmosphere. And we breathe with that atmosphere. And on the edge of the atmosphere there's another sphere, and another sphere, an ionosphere, pyrosphere, different spheres of energy in various forms. But we, within the island of our skin, have to breathe in and participate in this infinite energy called hay in exile. Now there are two ways of thinking about hay in exile, and I'm just drawn one of them, but I'm now going to show you that in this form the fallen consciousness that has placed the drive not in the heart but on the pubic bone pendant. There is a field of energy around that drive, and that energy field feels the need to drive, and it is dissociated from feeling, compassion and truth. Imagine this now, if we wrote this word in this manner, that's yod hey. That's think and feel, but there's dissociation from think and feel and drive. The drive now has got the bit between its teeth. It's driving with no connection between feeling and thinking. This is beauty, this is truth. And that which is good has slipped down, and the good has become bad, simply by islanding off, islanding that drive away from feeling and ideation. I think that we are brought up inside a society with no adequate education about this fact of primordial polarity. And because of this, all the troubles of the human race have arisen. There are no troubles that are not derived from precisely the same thing. Have another final look at that, because I'm going to throw it away. So we have a necessary, unbreakable trine of thinking, feeling and willing in any living being. There is always form there, that's the Greek word idea. There is always feeling there, affection, and there is always drive there, conation, pushing. There is no being that is not threefold in that sense. Now we want to see how this fall occurred, because if we know how the fall occurred, then we can do something about getting back and reversing the fall. We've drawn this many times. Imagine that coming from infinity, a force comes, turns round and closes itself. That's number six. Whence the word existence? Existence is derived from the same root as that number six, existere, out of six. When that force drives in from the infinite, it comes from a form called Ein, through Sof, and then it goes R, U, R, A, U, R, Or. An infinite observer, self-illuminated, and actively driving to differentiate, to make beings. And the letter B was originally a circle, a simple flat version of a sphere of being. The Hebrew letter Bet, which means a house or dwelling, is simply the letter B in its original form, a drawing of a sphere of encapsulation. Now we have, therefore, a being. Now, all things that are nothing but sentient power, power that feels itself. And whatever that power does, it remembers that it has done it. So coming from the infinite there, and winding in to itself here, to make a being and tie itself up there, it remembers that once it was free, and now it is bound. And it has alternatives. It can say, I have come from the infinite, wound in, and tied myself up, and made myself into a being, Or it could say, well, I don't like it, I'm going to rush back again into the infinite, because I don't like being. Because being is a limitation. And what happens if we do more of these? There's another one. I'm going to put questions to you now, so all the bright sparks can answer the questions. Are you ready, Greta? This being could remember that it's once been free and that it has become bound by its own action, and so this being also. And when these two beings come here, that's into contingency, that means we're touching each other, they disturb each other, they send a wave through each other. Now, at the moment of that stimulation, contingent stimulation, stimulation by touch, this being could start to pay attention to the stimulus from the other being. Let's call this being X and this Y. That's biology for girls and boys. Now, what happens at the point of stimulation, if this one remembers that it's infinite, what does he do with the energy input of the stimulus? If he remembers that it is really from the infinite, does he worry about it? Can it absorb it? Right, as long as it remembers its infinity, it can absorb the energy of the stimulus. And he's not worried about it. Insult me, Greta, and see if I get upset. No? That's an insult. Right. Now, you know, in biology, you talk about X chromosomes and Y chromosomes. So, well, I'd say that's a girl and that one's a boy. There are alternatives. Supposing that both of these beings forget that they're from the infinite, what are they likely to do when they disturb each other? Either reject it because they don't like it, or steal it because they do. Appropriate it. Now, you know the law of entropy, don't you? That everything that is in existence tends to run down. You know that if you have atmosphere around you that's cooler than you are, your body is losing energy in the form of heat to your environment, isn't it? Now, supposing one of these beings on its own, those have only got the one, the others have gone away, they've gone back to infinity, and this one has a certain amount of energy in it that's keeping it hot, but outside here it's cooler. What is going to happen to that being as it's losing energy to the environment? It will run down. Now, remember that it is sentient power. Will it like to run down? No. It will feel that it's losing being. Yeah? Losing being. Like you get if you speak to someone and they don't reply. You've given energy out. Like, how are you, darling? And he's so busy with the newspaper, he doesn't know you've spoken. Can happen. When it does, you've lost energy to the environment and you're diminishing. You are that much less for letting that energy out. And you've forgotten your infinite origin. So now we'll have a few of these beings. They've all come from the infinite, but they've forgotten that they're from the infinite. And they're losing energy by the law of entropy. They're running down, they're diminishing, they're getting smaller and flatter and more miserable. What are they going to do if they can? One is going to try to appropriate the other, right? So we'll have two of these in contingent stimulation. Now, when you take in food, all you're doing is taking in energy, aren't you? You break the food down to get the energy. In fact, the fu in food simply means force. If you said fo is force and od odd, which is found in Odin, a Norse god, means primarily life power. There is fu, force, odd, that's analytic activity of that force. How do you take in food? What do you do? You blow out or pull in? All right. Now they can't be exactly equal, can they? Because there is no single ultimate force that has brought them into being. They've come from infinity, haven't they? And so there's no question of them being equal finitely. We have a situation in which they both start to pull like this. This one is trying to pull a lump off that one, and that one's trying to pull a lump off that one. Now, one of them is going to tire before the other. You know, one of our proverbs is, somebody's got to give in, it doesn't have to be me. Remember? When I imagine, we'll call this the X one, that's the lady, and this is the Y one, that's the gentleman. And this one pulls harder than this one and does this. So that one diminishes there and goes like that. What is that diagram representing? It's representing primordial sexual relationship. Because the two beings which are sectioned, because they come from the original power, but they're cut away from each other by the fact of the binding integument, the skin, we now have this being drawing this being into this one in order to break it down, digest it, and appropriate the energy and avoid entropy, avoid the diminishing of self. Now, when this one feels that it's being drawn in, what does it tend to do? When it feels itself being appropriated, origin of coitus interruptus, it tries to preserve itself by backing out. And this one is trying to digest the bit it's got in. When this one tries to withdraw, this one starts trying to encroach, to pinch at least a bit of it, doesn't it? Supposing it manages to bite a piece off like that, and this one gets away with the flip, and it's now, the one that's escaped is a bit like this. It's got a little evidence it's been somewhere. And remember, the sentient power remembers everything that it has ever done. It remembers that once it was nearly eaten and got away with it. It lost a bit, but it didn't lose everything. And it remembers once it went into the dragon's cave, and it escaped. So it has a memory of a little kind of victory, doesn't it? Inside his mind, I entered and I escaped. And the dragon, the Chinese call it dragon power, the one that draws in, the dragon did not kill me. And I have a little evidence here to prove I was there. And I'm not going to let go of my evidence, am I? Because by that little piece of evidence, I reassure myself of the possibility of escape and the possibility of penetration into the dragon cave and mysteriously preserving myself in the process. So, when the digestive energies of the recipient here bite a piece off, the situation is now like this. And there's the bit that's been taken in. Now, that bit is a piece of living protoplasm because it is only sentient power and nothing else. Living protoplasm drawn in. What will it try to do with itself? Will it be happily absorbed? Or will it fight to maintain itself? It will fight. And will it be losing energy to its environment? Well, it depends whether it's going to use its intelligence. Isn't it going to try to grab a little bit? Now that is why the baby creates its own placenta. This thing that's been swallowed, if it can fasten onto the recipient and then eat at the expense of the recipient, it will get bigger, won't it? It may get so big like this that the unfortunate recipient gets more and more uncomfortable and determines, I'll let it out, it's safer out than in. Now that is the origin of childbirth. Now if you see this, is the child a child of the mother? No. What is it a child of? No, it isn't a child of the father. It's a child of the infinite power that made the father and the mother. Yes? And that's why Jesus says, call no man father on earth, because that fellow is too busy trying to get away with what little bit he'd got left. Wasn't he? So now we've got a situation in which inside every so-called male there is a dreadful terror of the female possibly absorbing it, taking it in, digesting it, leaving nothing, plus a memory of having got away. So if I can get back in there, leave my evidence and get out again, and the evidence will grow and come out and be my companion. And we, of the appendage, can make a gang. And we can fight the dragon. And would you believe that that is the origin of the George and the Dragon myth? Where George, riding his horse, got a spear which he puts into the dragon's throat. And the dragon seems to be in all the Georgian dragons thing doing quite well, really, since chewing off the ends of spears and really frightening George. Now imagine this is the origin of human sexual relationship. You doubt it? We all know for the fact that life began with monocell forms, and these monocells became multicells by self-subdivision. And we know that they couldn't possibly continue to exist without eating. Now there were two ways of eating. One way was to remember their infinite origin. But if you forgot that, eat your neighbor. So cannibalism on the neighbor is the alternative to dependency on the infinite. You may remember that on one occasion the disciples were rather upset about Jesus not having anything to eat much that day, and they thought he'd be hungry, and he replied, I have food you want not of, food you don't know about. And he was referring to this field power. Now all the energy without exception in the universe is field power. If we get it through fruits and roots and things, whatever we eat, it's only field power condensed. And we can get that, if we wish, directly from the field. But only if we remember that the field is the source of the energy. As soon as we forget that that infinite field is the source of our energy, we fall. And we fall down and we become an aggressor, trying to gobble up other beings or bite pieces off them and get away. And we believe that we can only survive by cannibalism on other beings. at its lowest level of gross materiality, physically, it simply means that one cell eats another cell in the primordial ocean or in the pond. If you get some pond water, look at it under the microscope, you will actually see cells engulfing in this way. They just go and flow around, make a U form, and then start digesting another living being. That isn't the only way of doing it, that's the way the fallen being does it. Now, as long as you remain at this cannibalistic level, at the very lowest gross level, it will permeate the rest of our being, and we will actually then prepare not only to gobble up people's bodies, like eating salads and buffalo and whatever, but at other levels of social relationship, one business will try to gobble up another. And you get those colossal, monolithic businesses. And they're continuously buying up little businesses. And the principle is the same. It is cannibalism in the field of commerce. And its root is in this biological cannibalism. Now, all the major religions have a series of symbols to represent this, and the symbols have been disguised for a very simple reason, which Socrates stated very clearly. If we did not have hewers of wood and drawers of water, we would not have time to think about philosophy. We don't need any other excuse or any other reason. Thinking takes energy. If you actually go and work like a farmer in the country from dawn till dusk doing heavy farm work, the probability of you having enough free energy to write Spinoza's Ethics is very remote. And because of that fact, society cuts itself. And it cuts itself into four main categories. The militarists, the priests, the businessmen, and the workers. That was the four category social structure based on the four letters of that name. There are thinkers and feelers, and there are urges, and there are commodity service controllers. Now, in all the religions, they have symbols, and the symbols are disguised for this reason. If everybody knew the symbol's meaning, if they saw the tremendous importance of it, if they knew they could escape slavery by it, then they would all learn it. And there would be nobody whatever being a slave. Be no slave. And if there were no slaves, then everybody would be actually having to look after themselves. Make their own shoes, their own trousers, their own jackets, cut their own hair, etc., etc. And therefore, unless somehow some masses of people can be kept away from that primal knowledge of this original polarity, unless they can be kept away, they are going to come on equal terms with the few who know. Now, many, many of the famous rabbis have said, without secrets, the universe cannot exist. Cannot. Let's think. We come from the infinite, and we turn round, we make a zone there, islanded off from infinity. Isn't that zone a secret? What does he mean to secrete? to hide? Doesn't it also mean, as in the glands in your body, that what they hide, taking in like this, at some point doesn't it come out again? You talk about glands in the secretions, don't you? They don't keep them in, do they? They make them. Adrenaline is made in one place and squirted into another place. So, every secret place like that has a function, because if it secretes itself properly, it will make something entirely unique, which it will then squirt out into the infinite life. And what it squirts out will be unique. So we'll have a few more of these. They're going to go in like this, and then they're going to go out like that. That the internal concentration at a critical point results in a unique essence. And that unique essence is then released into the infinite life, and the infinite life then enjoys it. Supposing they all made the same essence and all squirted the same essence into the infinite. Would that be terribly interesting for the infinite if they all made the same essence? No. Therefore, it is the will of the absolute, the will of the divinity, to draw in and make unique essences, to make unique issuances. So if that one is A and this one is B and this one is C, then from the point of view of the recipient infinite life, it can play tricks with itself, can't it? Because it can say, I can write C A B. I got a word out of it, cab. That's the cab in Kabbalah. The secret hidden. But I can spell B A C, back. And that's the back in a B A Bakulam. The cab is the feminine and the back is the masculine. And it can juggle with these letters which symbolize unique forces, and in the process it can make infinitely extensible delights for the infinite life. Now the function of that infinite life is simply to make an infinity of ever new emergence which increase delight infinitely. And that is its method of doing it. And you may recognize that that is the sign of Mars, isn't it? If you remember that Mars is made of Ma, which means mother, or substantial principle, the R means to discriminate, and the S means issuance. That Mars is a simple diagram derived from that rather more complex one. In the month of March, we're talking about seeds, where forces from the infinite have come in, wound into the seed, compressed themselves, and then flipped out into the universe to become May blossoms. You know the kind of delight you get when you see those blossoms appearing on the trees, don't you? And the delight of gardeners when they see a mutant. A new flower that wasn't there last year. And they carefully seize it and nurture it, and they breed out millions more. And make a lot of money out of their mutations, don't they? But the mutations are caused by the will of the absolute to ever more diversification of unique beauties. Now, the only thing that stops us from being infinitely creative is our obsession with our finite identification. Actually, every one of us is an infinitely creative genius. There are no non-geniuses. But remember what we said about Socrates' remark: if we don't manage to persuade a sufficient number of people to draw water and hew wood, we really won't have time to be thinking about the infinite. So in the ancient world of the differentiation of functions, two brothers who knew this secret said, I'll tell you what to do. I will fight to create the slave populations, that's the Kshatriyas, the militaries, and you meditate on the principles. I don't want you to fight, you meditate. I will build you a meditation place, and I will guard you. You meditate and find out new things from the infinite by absolute focus and contemplation. But when you have found them out, I want you to tell me, because I am going to make them appear in this world. And then we need a class of people to distribute them. The businessmen, the men that handle commodities and services. So if we can have a platform of hewers of wood and drawers of water, and we have the true high priest contemplating the next evolution that is willed by the absolute, and he connives with his brother, and he puts a crown on his brother's head and says, now you're an emperor, on condition that you protect me, because I am contemplating the next evolution, and you have to defend it, and you have to organize the fellows that are going to pick up the stones and pile them on top of each other to make the great pyramid of Gizeh. Every great work of art, every fantastically colossal monument has been built by the labor of men who had not designed it. At the command of a military king who could compel them with his army to do the work, but inspired by the contemplative high priest. Now, nothing holds a man or a woman in subjection, nothing deprives them of their infinite genius other than their identification with the role they play. There's nothing else, there's no mode of bondage on human beings other than that in which they acquiesce. If somebody comes along to you and says you are negative, you are deficient, and you think, oh gosh, I'm negative, I'm deficient. It's not that man that's done it, it's your acquiescence. Really? You're all geniuses. And some of you have been talked out of it. 95% of people have been talked out of the exercise of their genius so that the others can exercise their genius. So if we were to draw a pyramid, we have a saying, bricks, and then we begin to say the higher they go, the fewer. Now the funny thing is, when we did the drawing of the fallen phallic power, fell out of the heart into the pubic area, we represented the whole key to slavery. That's very interesting. If we could persuade a large number of human beings to descend and focus in the physical genital organ, and then persuade them by propaganda, by advertising, that this is the real meaning of life, this genital excitation, this seeking of genital friction and release of tension. If we can persuade 95% of the human race that that is the real objective of life, namely pleasure, and particularly genital pleasure, if we can persuade them that, then they will not rise up, they will not lift up their hearts, they will not center in their sensitivity, but they will be trapped in the external stimulus. Now, God says, I have created with a hay. And he said, I have left the hay, this letter is for hay, open downwards to sin, time, matter. Life is open downwards to sin, life, time, matter. The infinite life open downwards means towards material, physical identification. If you think that you are a physical body and not a spiritual entity, you're orientated downwards. Now, at the bottom of this letter, hey, here, like that, not in the land of sin, are a lot of souls, that is, these beings that have been encapsulated. This is spirit, and when encapsulated is soul. There are a lot of beings, and those beings continuously look downwards to the possibility of sin in the time-matter world. They're so terrified of it that they're not going to sin. What is it like if you imagine that you're in heaven, and that, you know, there are seven heavens like this. You're in the lowest heaven, and you're so near to sin, time, matter that you keep looking at it and wondering about it, but you're very nervous about it, so you won't commit it, because you don't like the idea of punishment for sin, so you're not going to commit it. And what is your feeling like? Frustrated. And yet they're not going to sin. I won't draw them all, but imagine I've drawn 99 up from there. And there's one down here, and the weight of the others on top of it, push it down there. And that's called the black sheep. Now that one sins. But the funny thing about it is that in sinning in time matter, it gets an education that the others that don't go into time matter don't get. So doesn't it finally come to the end of its sin? Doesn't it finally discover the inefficiency of sin? So doesn't it finally come out? Now when it comes out from the land of sin, does it just go back where it was? No, no. The rabbis are too smart for that. The black sheep, having come out, goes right up there to where the window is for a bit of fresh air. Because this is open here to the infinite. Sin means separation from the infinite life. Doesn't mean anything else. Just to disjoin yourself from infinity. So the black sheep has now gone up, and it's the one that's up near where the breathing hole is. That is why she said there's more rejoicing over the one who came back than the 99 that never got lost. And there's one lovely Kabbalistic statement where God is looking at the 99. And they keep peering over into the land of sin. Terribly frightened of it, and he gets mad at them and goes, psst, and he kicks them down. It's absolutely intolerable that they should continuously fascinate themselves with sin and never get the education that would allow them to give up sinning. So the black sheep now is up near the breathing hole. He can meditate on the infinite, but he's still in the world of being. He hasn't vanished, like a poet once did a translation of the Buddhist scriptures called The Light of Asia. In it he said, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. Well, that's given a lot of Europeans an idea that individuation gets lost. It doesn't. The unique essence remains eternally unique. The black sheep is up there. He can breathe the infinite and draw in beautiful new thoughts, even new thoughts of new sins he hadn't thought of yet. then he might go down again and reincarnate, pushing his way, elbowing his way through the anxious, diving in again. One never knows what he's going to do. But when he's been down to examine the new sin enough, then he will go back up and have a fresh breath. Now imagine that this is basic ontology. It's the basis of all existences of all universes. And we are all in it. We think, we feel, and we will. And we will about what we think and feel. And we feel about what we think and will. And we think about what we feel and will. And this trine is inseparable in us as individuals. And there is no escape ever from that trine of unique ideation, affection, coronation for each one of us. But the center of each one of us is a unique contribution. And it's called talent. Now you know the Lenten talent means seed. It means the seed or potential on which you are fixated or crucified. Every talent you have is an imperative to develop it. In the parable of the talents, one of the most terrible parables there is the story of three men, and the Lord comes and he gives to one man 10 talents, to another 5, and to another 1. And then he goes away and then he comes back. What did you do with your talent? Remember the Lent seed. They are lent to you, potentials, and you are fixated on them, and yet you have to develop them. Because the one who gave them, the Lord, comes to you and says, what have you done with your talents? And the one with 10 talents says, I made another 10 talents, profit. And the Lord says, good, here's another 10. And the one with 5 talents, he says, I made 5 talents. And the Lord says, good, here's 5. Notice the Lord is discriminate. He doesn't give 10 to the fellow who only made 5. Then he comes to the one with only 1 talent. He says, what have you done with yours? He says, Lord, I had heard that you were a man who reaps where he doesn't sow, and I was afraid, so I buried my talent. And the Lord says to him, what, you thought that about me? Then the least you could have done would have been to lend out that talent to usury to show me a profit. And he took the talent away from him and said, to him that hath, to him shall be given. To him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away. The talents you use grow more and more and more, and the infinite supply comes in and it gives you profit. And the talent you're afraid of developing, it withers away inside you, that one, the power from the infinite takes it away and leaves you with nothing, and you become a shell, rabbinically a husk, the skin of a possibility, but no possibility. You've thrown it away by allowing it not to be exercised. Now we have a short outline there of our relationships, of our possibilities with each other. Now there is a thing called kindness. Now kindness is from kin. It means those beings that are put together, that are similar in form, in power, in function, in ideation, coronation, affection, they are similar. We say they are akin. Kindness consists in treating a being according to its kind. So that if you say find a worm, on a stone instead of in the ground, and you are kind, you say the proper place for worms is not stone, so you pick it up and put it on the soil. If you saw a little bird just fallen out of a nest, you would put it back in the nest. And you would do everything according to its kind. Now when we draw the sea, like that, that's the surface, and that's the depth, here's the land. And the sun is up here, shining. And in this sea there are monocells, like this. All the ones on the surface are irradiated very powerfully with the sun. And the sun energizes them, and they become very mobile. And they are the ground of spermatic forms with tails, and the origin of vertebrates. But deeper down under here, blocked by the others above, down here, are monocells, sun-starved. But the pull of the moon affects water. So we'll put a moon down here, bounce the sun up there. And in a friendly way we can call them sunnies and loonies. It's technical. We're not being rude. The ones that are sun-driven tend to be very aggressively swift. And they become the great predators. They become the streamlined sharks and so on, tearing about the ocean. Remember, if they've forgotten their origin, they're a predator. They're going to eat somebody up and get away with it. Meanwhile, down below here, sun-starved, they can't swim so fast. You know, there's the very great depths of the sea. And the fish is living, and if you bring them up suddenly, they burst. They're grown under pressure, evolved under pressure, and they are controlled by phases of the moon. And they're not streamlined like sharks. They're not that kind of beam, they're swallowing beams. I'll draw you a little portrait, if you can see it, of a being of the depths. I'm not exaggerating this. This is a fish of the depth. You see that? That's a real fish of the depth. If you do your depth fish studies, you'll find lots and lots of fish with great big mouths, not very big long bodies. And they're all horribly disguised except for the teeth. And they're just waiting for dinner. But they haven't got enough solar power to swim past. So they're idling along, covered with funny lumps and crags and bits of seaweed and anything whatever to disguise their intention. Would you believe that is the origin of feminine fashion? True. True. Don't blame me. What does it mean then if we're going to be kind to beings? It means that the slow moving loonies have somehow to devise methods of avoiding the dictatorial aggressiveness of the fast-moving sharks, which are streamlined. This also means that the sharks, when they're not on colour, on form, they shouldn't go too deep, especially if they're tired. What is required is an intelligent self-appreciation of one's unique organization and structure, and a good will to be kind to all beings. So only if you've really finished with yourself, I mean finished with your life form, and you've nothing else to do with it, then you might deliberately go down, swim low, slowly, where you can be devoured by a hungry creature. And that's being kind to other beings, well-footed friends and so on. Now our human relation has been disguised like that by an intelligent oligarchy who know absolutely clearly, with thousands of years of this same tradition, that the world is going to continue like this until everybody remembers their infinite origin. The prophecy about that is that in those days no man shall teach another of God, for all shall know him. It is possible to begin to remember one's infinite origin. And what happens if you suddenly realize you don't have to chew other people or their businesses or steal their motor cars or whatever they've got, fountain pens or whatever. You can actually borrow a fountain pen permanently if you ask nicely. I got one, didn't I, at Christmas? Very nice one, thank you very much. Even though it was Irish manufacture. It's possible actually to be surprised if you play the rule of the infinite with all that you need. Why is that? Because if you're not a cannibal predator, people are not so scared of you as they would be. And if you really don't bite them, you know what they'll do? They'll give you a piece of their cheese sandwich. It's true. I've actually been in a house the other day, and I was given some grapes. That's only because they didn't think I was going to eat them if I got the grapes. I'm not being cynical. Now that is what we've got to consider. What we've had there is a very bare outline of a Kabbalistic doctrine. We're just going to write at base. I'm going to put a Q there and a B and an L and an H. The H is really fifth letter, not an eighth. I'm going to read the letters to you in their true significance. The Q is a kuf, which means back of your head, which means impulsive behavior. The B means to bind, to encapsulate, to control. The L means to stimulate and conjoin with, and the H at the bottom means life. It means that if your impulses to cannibalism, to separative activity, are controlled by you, and you then determine the stimulus situation in which you put yourself, you will enter into life. Now that is the word Kabbalah, and it simply means that if you wish to enter into life, you must become a self-stimulating being. And to become a self-stimulating being, you must break the tyranny of reactivity to other stimuli that come to you from outside. As long as you are conditioned by stimuli that come to you from outside, you're not a properly self-stimulating being. And at the back of your head, in the Hebrew that letter, it's a drawing of the back of the head like that. And there's your spine. It looks like our P, but of course it's a Q. Hence mind your P's and Q's. When a person talks out of the back of the head, we mean they talk impulsively, don't we? And rubbish. If you say, I will talk rubbish out of the back of my head unless I get hold of myself, and that's the letter B, I must bind, I must encapsulate my energies. Then when I've got hold of them, I must use the letter L, the Lamed, which is an ox goad. I must stimulate me. I must be a self-stimulating being. Otherwise, I will be at the mercy of anybody else that stimulates me. And if I am urgent, ancestrally driven, but bound, self-stimulating, I enter into life. My life is only truly possible when I am a self-stimulating being with self-control. The self-control stops me reacting to the stimuli that other people throw at me. It doesn't matter what religion, what philosophy, what secret society, what symbols there may be in all the systems of the world, they all refer to the same thing. Self-control, self-stimulation to rescue us from being controlled by other beings and directed by their stimuli.